Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about open borders with John Washington, author of a terrific book called The Case for Open Borders. John Washington is a staff writer at Arizona Luminaria, a community-focused media outlet where he writes about the border and climate change and democracy and more. He's also written for The Atlantic, The Washington Post, The Nation, and The Intercept, among other places. John Washington, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Really happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here and for writing this book, which I highly recommend to everyone, The Case for Open Borders. You know, I often hear from right-wing pundits and politicians in the U.S. that the so-called left, meaning elected Democrats of all things, are in favor of open borders. And my response is usually, no kidding? Really? Maybe I should give them a second try. Maybe I should vote for some of them. What? Where are they? Are they keeping it secret? So my question is there some sort of stealth campaign for open borders by these corporate flacks? Or, are my politicians that I like still just the fantasies of the right wing?
Yeah, they're definitely the fantasies. You know, this idea of open borders has long been a boogeyman, sometimes a straw man. This, as you say, fantasy that is used to leverage against anyone remotely left of center or even approaching center at this point. I mean, the what has become within the realm of normal in immigration policy is deliberately torturing people, is ripping families apart, is banishing people to countries they've never been to. And anytime you try to pull back some humanity into the way that we talk about how we manage borders, how we manage people who are forced to cross them or who choose to cross them, people get painted as being for open borders. And we don't have politicians who are for open borders. We have had some politicians who have gone as far as say they want to abolish ICE. We have had some politicians who have said that they think they should decriminalize that very act of crossing a border without authorization. Those are positive steps towards basic senses of justice, upholding human dignity and human rights, but that's not open borders either. That is just not criminalizing people for crossing them.
So what would actual open borders look like if you can summarize a book, and what's the basic argument in favor of doing it?
There's a lot of ways you can kind of conceive of what open borders would be like. I think maybe to start with, I usually say what it's not. Open borders, in my conception, is not no borders. I'm not currently... In this book, I wasn't advocating or really trying to understand what a world completely without countries would be like. I think that that isn't something that's politically feasible right now. I think that doing something to address the inherent harms with the concept of nation state would be a good idea. However, my conception is pretty simple, is that the presumption would be that people are allowed to go where they need to or want to. And if that includes crossing an international divide, that's okay. We have some very basic examples of this already in place. Most famously probably is the EU, the Schengen zone, the passport-free zone, which is being limited, and there are restrictions being put on and passport-free travel in the EU right now. But if somebody... My family's from Romania. My mother grew up in Romania. She was a de facto refugee. I have a lot of cousins and family there still. If and or when they want to move from Romania to a Western or Northern European country, which many of them have done, they can do so. They have to jump through a bunch of bureaucratic hoops. It's not the easiest process in the world. They need to check a lot of boxes, fill out forms, etc. But they can do so. In fact, that bureaucratic challenge and hoop jumping is something that you would think that people who now proclaim to be border restrictionists would want. Because what open borders would also do in the way that I and many others who are advocating for it is allow folks to know who is in the country and who is not. Because if people could come to ports of entry from, say, Mexico or anywhere else and try to enter the United States, and again, the presumption would be that they would be allowed to enter in, they would have to register. That's a basic and very, I think, not too burdensome requirement that they would register and say, look, this is where I'm from, this is who I am, and this is where I'm going. This happens all the time when people move within the United States of America. I grew up mostly in Ohio. I was born in New York. I grew up in Ohio. I've lived in six different states. And every time it's a pain in the ass and it's a hassle. You have to register to vote. You have to go to the DMV, do all this stuff. But it's both in my incentive and the incentive of the community that I'm entering that we have this understanding of who I am and where I am. So I can now pay taxes. I can receive some, all too meager benefits. I can vote, all of these things. And when I start talking about benefits and voting, people start bristling often. And right now, the way that we have it set up in the United States is that even if people are legally migrating, have authorization to move into the United States, they don't get to receive benefits, especially the means-tested benefits, welfare, Social Security. They don't get to vote even right away. There is a long process of sort of embedding themselves, weaving themselves into the social fabric that is set in law that they must go through before they can actually access those benefits or participate fully as citizens. So I think that also makes sense. It's like, you pay into the pot a little bit before you start taking from the pot. If there's an emergency, we also have systems to deal with that. But also, you enter in and get to know your community a little bit before you start making decisions through the ballot box. That also makes sense. I think that these are sort of basic common sense ways that we can sort of allay some of the fears about people are going to start sucking dry the, welfare coffers or start changing, electorally at least, the makeup of these societies.
I mean, I think an important point that maybe we and everybody else could agree on is that whether you can cross a border can be a separate question from what should your citizenship status be the day or the month or the year after you've crossed a border. But I think to your point that people shouldn't get anything for a while. I wonder because what if my family happens to have recently crossed a border and one of my family members suddenly becomes very ill and needs health coverage, which in, most wealthy countries is a human right, but in the United States is some sort of commodity. And, even these right-wing libertarians for open borders argue that they're for open borders because having people come in, even though they get benefits, actually enriches the people who are already here rather than impoverishing them. So financially, it's okay to act as if you actually had human sympathy for these people. So I don't know about with the withholding benefits
Well,
bit.
I think withholding benefits is maybe putting it a little bit more strongly than I meant it. There isn't a state in this country on the books that withholds emergency medical care, even if people aren't allowed to pay. So I think that obviously that would continue. I'm not saying that's always the case in practice. I think there's some sort of ways that people are, pushed away from trying to access care, especially now with this heightened sense of fear, a pervasive sense of fear.
Or put
But I
in
think,
endless debt after they get the health care.
of course, and like, and I think we don't have the time to sort of litigate our health systems, which need absolutely complete revamping. And one of the points I make, and I think is really important to underscore in the book, is that open borders is not the solution to many of the underlying problems about why people move or why people are nervous about people moving. So we have very real other problems that we are facing. I mean, existential problems, climate change, gross inequalities, rampant inequalities, across the globe. Healthcare access, reproductive justice, like all of these things aren't going to be solved by opening borders, we need to also address them if we're going to actually find some stability towards the way that people move and not compel people or force people to move. So we need to address those. And I could talk a little bit about that in the book. Climate change, to take one example, opening borders is going to be some way that we mitigate harms that come from climate change. People live in areas that are becoming increasingly uninhabitable.
Right.
Allowing them to move safely into places that are habitable is an obvious step, and that is included in this idea of open borders. But that doesn't address the underlying problem. The underlying problem must be addressed if we don't want to see a billion people forced from their homes in 30 years or something like that.
Agree 100%. So what are the main advantages you see to open borders, and what the heck is it that has everybody so scared that open borders is used to smear people who aren't even in favor of open borders?
Yeah. Before I answer that, and I think that I'm starting kind of with a 30,000 foot view, and I think that this approach kind of starts answering it, and then I'll try to address it more concretely. But the way that we have set up the bordering regime right now is that some people have less rights. Some people are targeted, arrested, tortured, excommunicated for no other reason than because of who they are or where they are. That's what borders do in the way that we ha currently have them conceived. Borders threaten people, kill people, just because of the color of their passport, because of where they're from, or because of where they're moving. This to me, and I think that sometimes we don't pull back and think about that basic concept, is a gross violation of the most basic sense of human rights that we have. We have tried hard collectively as society over the past 100 years to not discriminate against people because of their sex, their gender, their race, their ethnicity, their language, their religion, etc. Those are all what are called immutable characteristics, things that can't really be changed about yourself. And yet, where you're from, that's like the most obvious thing you can't change. And yet, we thrust this incredible violence on these people just because of where they were born. I think standing up, recognizing that, and standing up for the principle that people should not face that discrimination is a really important basic step. And I think what it would do is it would extend this fight for basic freedoms and dignity and human rights beyond where we've gotten. And we have a lot of work to do still in upholding all those other basic freedoms and rights that we're mentioning. But I think extending it is going to sort of complete this sense of let's not discriminate against people because of these immutable characteristics. That's a moral argument there. I think there's a lot of other ways to approach it. And the one that a lot of people kind of grasp very readily is the economic one. I don't like to start there because I think that I think it potentially risks further commodifying migrants. I think it sort of falls into the system, this hyper-capitalist system that in fact is uprooting so many people right now and has been causing both implanting harm into people and forcing them to leave and implanting fear into people who are on the receiving end of that. But it is good economics to open borders. There, in fact, are very, very few economists who have even tried to argue otherwise. There's a couple famous examples, but when you read their work closely and you really kind of drill down to the nitty-gritty, you recognize that they're making really sort of far-reaching claims about the potential effects on a very small sliver of our population. And overwhelmingly, migration, even fast migration, and even a lot of migration is good for obviously the migrants, which we should be a factor here. And it's really good for the receiving communities as well, both at the regional level and the national level, even the micro level. And there's been studies to show this that cities who have been, have seen a lot of migrants come very quickly have been able to manage. That doesn't mean that they always do manage well, because a lot of times the response, increasingly the response, is to lock them up, to scapegoat them, to, in the case of like New York City, why were people being held in hotels in New York when a lot of Venezuelans were being bused from Texas and elsewhere into the city? They were being first held in hotels, and they opened up at one point a former prison, some, sports arenas. Like, let them figure it out on their own. I mean, I think that some welcoming steps is a good idea, but trying to contain them is a slippery slope towards trying to detain them. And there we enter into the exact situation that we're in now, where we're ramping up towards 100,000 plus detention beds. So I'm sort of digressing a little bit about how we receive people, but you asked like what the basic argument is. Economically, it's you can't read a white paper, you can't read a serious economist's addressing of this without taking away that it is overall positive. And not just in strict economics about like what sort of bottom line jurisdictions are going to be having, but also in terms of just basic labor as well, that migrants don't take jobs. That is a really sort of antiquated or even antediluvian idea of how economies work. There's not a fixed set of jobs in any economy. Jobs often beget more jobs. And that is something that we have seen with even, again, rapid rises in migration. So a lot of these fears are really built up on very little. And once you start picking at, and once you start asking questions about, okay, well, what is the reality? Do we have evidence for this? You start seeing that it's a bit of a house of cards, this anti-immigrant argument, that really they're not a threat to our economies, they're not a threat to our jobs, they're not a threat to housing, they're not a threat to security either. So what are we left with? Well, there's this ideological animus, there's this sort of ginned up fear that politicians have been using for a long time, politicians and just downright racists or nativists. And it's a winning strategy in many regards, unfortunately. I mean, we see that migrants are what fuel, and fear of migrants are what fuel a lot of politicians. Think of Donald Trump. Obviously, he's hung his hat electorally on fear of the migrant for 10 years now.
Yeah, well, lots of wonderful points there. And my favorite is that to get rid of closed borders, we might have to get rid of xenophobia as sort of the last acceptable bigotry to the liberals who are not generally the racists and so forth, which would, of course, make wars more difficult and all kinds of side benefits. I always wonder, though, about this notion that, well, if people migrate to wealthier countries such as the United States, that will benefit them and their friends back home and the people who were already in the United States, because it seems based on the idea that they'll start more or less working and living like people in the United States, which on average do many times the environmental damage of anybody anywhere else on the planet. Far short, of course, of the billionaires. If you could just rein in the billionaires, the environment might be okay. But your average American, typical US lifestyle, does intense environmental damage in comparison to what these people were doing before they theoretically migrated. So, you know, it's not all sunshine and rainbows unless we figure that one out, is it?
No, yeah, I mean, I think that is a fair concern. I mean, we have been absolutely profligate in our energy consumption for the past 100 plus years. But I think that the solution to that doesn't lie at all in prohibiting migration. And in fact, you look at so-called developing countries in the global south, and you see that the rate of emissions rising is higher. That's the rate of acceleration of emissions is raising more quickly than it is in the global north. Overall, obviously, the global north still emits far, far more. But keeping those people behind in the global south isn't really the solution. What is the solution is thinking hard collectively, and I think breaking down barriers to that thought, including borders to that sort of collective thinking, is really important to start addressing how we can rethink our energy consumption, how we can rethink what we're extracting, what we're using, and how what our relationship is with this earth. I think opening up borders actually help us do that.
Some of the points I really appreciated in the book. We can't possibly get to all of them, but the fact that culture isn't blocked at all by borders anymore. Diseases are not blocked at all by borders anymore. Multinational corporations have been allowed to eliminate borders in their business practices. It's just people. That's the only thing that we seem to be blocking, right? And it's a very, very strange idea when you come to think of it in those terms.
No culture is static. No group of people is static. No community is completely fixed. I mean, that's never been the case. I mean, you can look at the most extreme examples of like this is like a lockdown country like North Korea. People still get out. And okay, like let's say that people had this just desperate idea that they must like maintain the current status quo or hark back to a previous status quo, like make America great again.
Or an imagined previous status quo.
Yeah, exactly. What's the actual end game there? So like let's say that nobody at all could come into your country. Let's say that your culture remained static or was able to slowly evolve as it was. Like we would have like completely immobilized populations. Well, what if some of the people within the country wanted to leave? Like, how exactly does that work? Or let's say that you're able to wall off places completely, 30-foot wall, 50-foot walls, moats, alligators, burning oil, like all this stuff around a country that is undergoing political upheaval or has suffered cataclysmic effects of climate change. You're just gonna let the people suffer and die behind those walls? What sort of a conception of humanity or of like the global community do we have that that would be okay? My first book was about asylum, and one of the things that I found when I was doing research about the early origins of asylum is that every culture, pretty much that we've been able to identify, the most far-flung, the most ancient, have had some way to actually codify or at least put into practice this idea of welcoming the aggrieved stranger. That is like one of the fundamental precepts of what civilization is. And to all of a sudden start rejecting that because of what? Because we're again, like these false fears is really, really a rejection of the just basic conceptions of humanity.
Well, I think it's scapegoating foreigners so that you don't blame people actually responsible for problems in the world. There's an argument I've seen from certain supporters of open borders, and they consider this a positive development, that open borders would allow us to reduce environmental standards, labor standards, human rights standards to a lowest common denominator. I don't know why they couldn't do the opposite, but what do you predict, and how would it matter how it was done in terms of opening borders?
Sorry, maybe I didn't quite follow the re like lowering like standards around environmental concerns to the lowest common
Sure,
denominator.
you can pollute more in Mexico. You open the border between the U.S. and Mexico. Now, necessarily, the laws must
I see.
drop to the Mexican standard, and you can pollute more in the U.S. Now, you can't really form a labor union in the U.S. You can in Europe. You have open borders. Now, you can't form a labor union in Europe anymore, etc.
Yeah, I see. I mean, I think that's basically a silly argument. I mean, no one like seriously making the argument for open borders is saying that countries can't have laws and have their own laws. Like, no one's saying that. And so, yeah, you can and should still regulate, like, establish safety standards and regulate, things like emissions or like allow people to form unions. Like, in fact, that is, I think, going to be overall helpful in the end. One other sort of way of saying something I've already addressed is that the important corollary to open borders is fighting also not for the freedom to move, but for the freedom to remain. And those things that you're just mentioning are going to help people stay. The United States, in a recent 5-year period, spent 11 times more on border enforcement than it did in climate change mitigation. So, Let's say that your ultimate goal is to stop people from coming to the United States, which obviously that's not my goal, but let's say that's your goal. You're not thinking very strategically here because just building up walls, we have decades upon decades of evidence showing that that doesn't really work. Just building up walls, just doing more interior enforcement, that's not very effective. What would be more effective is trying to help these people stay at home. So focusing on climate change that is not going to be pushing people out of their homes and out of their countries is going to actually be more effective in stopping people from moving.
Yes, well said. We've got just 2 or 3 minutes left. A group I work for, World Beyond War, has a conference coming up looking at abolition movements on borders, police, prisons, war, nuclear weapons, etc. And we're going to be looking at the pros and cons and the strategies and whether it makes sense to push for abolition of something or complete opening of something versus reforms and tweaking, and which is easier to move forward on and which is a stronger argument and so forth. What has been your experience? What do you find are the advantages, if any, of demanding open borders versus slightly reformed borders?
I think there's two things. I think we need both. One of the reasons I think we've gotten into this mess is the left, and I use that term collectively here to define both politicians and people traditionally defined as being on the left. I don't think they've done a very good job messaging around borders and immigration. And I think that we should not be scared about the term open borders. I think that the right, this is the first question you ask, has co-opted this idea, has painted it in a way that doesn't make sense, has said that people are for it that are not. People who are for it should proudly proclaim it and say, I believe in the basic human rights and they should not be infringed upon just because of where someone is or where they moves. Like, I think we should start there with the principle. And I think that follows that there are and should be open borders. So fighting for the abolition of the bordering regime as we have it, I think, is important. I think it will set a standard, and I think it will stop us from falling down this slippery slope of sort of acquiescing to the right. At the same time, we need to fight for immediate reforms because people are dying and suffering in immigration detention and getting caught up in this dragnet. And as we fight towards open borders, we also need to be like, wow, like this is not okay. Our neighbors should not be targeted. We should not be moving towards 100,000 beds. We should be scaling down towards, 0 beds. But every person who's picked up, every person who spends another night in detention is something that we should be trying to fight. And that, if you want to call that a reform, all right. But I think that we need to address some of these sort of harms and processes that are maybe on the edges of this bigger conversation at the same time.
Very well said. John Washington's book, among his other books, is called The Case for Open Borders. John Washington, thank you for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thanks, David. Really enjoyed the conversation.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.